From iAfrican Media, this is iAfrican Bites, a podcast that features commentary on African news, insights, opinions, and analysis with tech industry leaders and professionals. The podcasts are from interviews conducted by the iAfrican team, whether at events or when needed for commentary. I'm Badawun Kosokwane, host and editor-in-chief for iAfrican.com, spelled www.iafrican.com.
Welcome to iAfrican Bites, another episode of iAfrican Bites with me, your host, Badawun Kosokwane. In this episode, we're joined by Thoriso Rangata, founder and CEO of KTO Digital, a software development company that's been doing a lot of positive work within the South African tech space. We're here to have a conversation with him to find out about his journey and find out about, you know, the journey of an SMME within the South African technology landscape. Brother Thoriso, thank you for joining us. We were referred to you by Qiniso Mazubane, Managing Director at Indiza Information System, who also is the sponsor of this segment, Uncomfortable Conversations. How do you and Qiniso know each other? Where do you guys meet? How do you, yeah.
Thank you for having me. I go quite long way back with Qiniso, specifically with Indiza.
Okay.
We first engaged while I was still incubated by an incubator called Softstart, BTI, a technology incubator, which was our early days in business. And I think he had done previously some partnership work with the incubator, and he had an opportunity, a project where he needed services and wanted to collaborate with a tech partner. And that's where we got introduced and been working together since then.
Yes. Now, the interesting part is that, you know, you and Qiniso are both peers in the sense that you're both founders and CEOs of, you know, technology startups. What insights or what do you learn from each other?
So I think it's more of me learning from him.
Oh, okay,
I mean, by the time we started working together, I think we were 2 years in the business, and he had been 10 years in the in the business, right? So, you can imagine that, of course, at the time, a lot of things that we still needed to learn,
100%,
and a lot of mistakes that he had made that we were still to make. And I think I took him more as a mentor than anything else. And I mean, I call him for the dumbest things.
Like what? Like, just share with us. Like, I mean, is it for referrals, contacts?
Yeah. So as menial as, hey, I've got a government project or a government tender. This is my very first government tender. What do I do? How do I engage with government?
With government,
I've got a letter of award. What does it mean? You know, as menial as that, I think for the first 3 years of our business, we've avoided government opportunities. We didn't tender for anything.
That's interesting. We'll get into that later.
Yes,
I want to go into that.
I've got my own receptions on that.
But don't worry, we're going to air it out here.
We'll get into that. But I strictly avoided government business for the first 3 years of our business. And I think when also COVID came in, we needed to also pivot how we were doing our business and really look at some of the processes that we had. Okay. And private sector was not doing too well in COVID. I think from our side, immediately when hard lockdown hit, we had a 70% revenue drop immediately. So we had to really look at how we do business, who we do business with, who can afford to do business with us. And we literally got our first tender during COVID.
During
so
COVID.
We started tendering.
At the height of COVID.
At the height of COVID.
Okay, cool.
So we started tendering literally in 2020.
Okay.
So that's where even a lot of phone calls were going out to queue. Just getting insights. Okay, how do I handle a government client now? How do I approach it? How do we get started? How do we, I mean, with private sector, it's simple. You go in, convince a person. 100%. You don't have to worry about the process.
100%.
Once you get the business, you go in, you deliver, you're out, right?
100%.
Whereas with government, there's all these protocols and processes.
100%.
And we needed to find our way around.
We'll
it.
Definitely get into that. You know, there's a whole lot we need to get into that. But, you know, the technology space is such a niche industry, and it's good to see the brotherhood between K2O and Indesa Information Systems. And I think kudos to the two of you. Now, I want to just backtrack a bit before we get into the heavy stuff. I noted in your bio, you have a background in, you know, correct me, IT audit and compliance officer. What is an IT audit compliance officer? Yeah, let's start there.
Okay, so I graduated from CTI after mm-hmm. studying computer science.
Okay.
And literally my first job internship mm-hmm. Was in a role with a company called T-Systems,
okay.
which is a German company. Yeah. They were based here, in the head offices in South Africa were based in Midrand.
Yeah.
And I joined the company, started off as a compliance officer. They gave it different roles, quality control administrator, but it was essentially to do with IT auditing, security controls, and compliance around that. So they had the two biggest contracts,
okay.
IT contracts in South Africa, which was Eskom and Transnet,
okay.
and we were responsible for the security compliance there.
Okay.
So I started my internship there. And quickly saw an opportunity where my manager was going on early retirement.
Okay.
And I told him, hey, I think I can take your role.
I can take your job.
let's try it. So it was mainly annoying people, really.
Okay.
Everyone, approaching anyone who was responsible for giving any IT service to that to those divisions,
okay.
which were the government entities.
Okay. Within Eskom
and Transnet. Yeah. So anyone who was responsible for the day-to-day IT services, we had to ensure that they were working within the confinement of the security standards and controls. So doing continuous internal audits and going to even the level of technicality of running scripts to make sure configurations are done right and assessing security requirements, penetrations, vulnerabilities existing 100%. In the environment and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the current advancements, you know, in automation and AI, how has, you know, that reshaped, you know, that specific, you know, IT audit and compliance? Is it still even relevant? Has certain functions that you used to do automated? What's going on within that space?
So I think we are slightly overestimating AI at the moment.
Okay.
I don't think it's necessarily at the level where we are praising it to be, simply because there's still so much manual interventions and human interventions that are required in any sphere of current daily operations, right? So we use, we've got the likes of your ChatGPTs, which currently you would use it as a working tool, you would use it as a context writer for whatever you're working on, but you will still need to do the job. You will still need to verify everything that comes out of it. So I don't think we are at a position where we can say AI is currently here to replace anything, but we do benefit off of it. We can use it complementary to what we are doing now. It does make things more efficient. I use ChatGPT for literally copywriting anything. And proposals and quite a lot of things. And getting insights on certain level of issues that we might be experiencing. It's just, for me, it's just a next level of a Google, a research tool. So, but there's also in other sectors and other industries, other AI solutions
100%.
That sort of have been brought in place to optimize and make things more efficient. But I think the automation, I mean, I was looking at one of the Gartner researchers, and they say that currently across the world, across sectors, industries, there is, for every organization that has fully automated, there's still a 30% opportunity to automate even further.
Okay.
So I don't think we are ever or will ever be at a position where we can say 100% no human intervention 100%. Required or oversight. But, you know, a lot of things have changed.
100%. And things are still yet to change. Yeah. 100%. Look, you said something very interesting. Two biggest contracts at the time, T-Systems had it, Eskom and Transnet. T-Systems disinvested from South Africa some years ago.
Yes.
Do you know who's currently, who's playing that vacuum now?
So I know that there was an acquisition of T-Systems South Africa by Gijima.
Gijima, yes.
I only have high-level information on it, but I know that some of the, obviously with the acquisition, some of the pre-existing contracts and opportunity work would have went that side.
Okay.
I know some of the my fellow colleagues from my T-System days are now with Gijima. So there was that merger acquisition type of process that happened. I do know that some of the contracts were already, because I know the life of some of the contracts with Eskom and Transnet had come to an end with T-Systems. So there was that whole bid for those opportunities at the time. So probably the big guys took over.
We'll come into that. The role of, you know, SMMEs, startups in getting those type of contracts, or sort of being subcontracted in those type of contracts. But let's take a step back. 2016, 7 years ago, you started KTO. Now, what type of founder are you? And I'll ask this. You know, you get two types. You get a founder that identifies a problem, you know, and then creates the solution. And you got a second type that creates the solution and goes try and find, you know, what problem to solve with the solution. Which one are you?
I think it would be...
And where KTO fits in those two categories?
I think it would be very hard to create a solution without a problem,
yes.
Right? So you would essentially be creating the problem. So that's not the right approach to take. But I think with everything that we have done, we've identified the problem first. And it has been the reason behind a lot of our strategic moves in the business.
Okay.
And the approach in what we should focus on as services that we should offer and products that we should offer. Generally looking at the market size and what problems exist out there and where we can fit in.
Okay.
So we create the solutions for the problems.
Yeah. Let's go deep into that conversation. What problem was KTO founded to solve?
So, I think after my life at T-Systems, I had moved to a company called, a fintech company called Summit Financial Partners, which was essentially on its way to being a digital debt counselor, right? So, there I was playing a role of managing and leading the technology and the development team in trying to optimize solutions and systems as much as possible. And the one common trend, I mean, I think from every environment that I've been in, from T-Systems and all the projects that we've engaged in, we've seen that a solution, I mean, T-Systems sort of major revenue generator from what I could see was on-selling technology products and then the support and implementation and the consulting service of the right. So for me, across the board from all the organizations I've dealt with, I realized that we are introducing all these products, your Microsoft solutions, your best practice tools, as they're called, but into the environments and your enterprise solutions, but they are also rigid. And with every client, the frustration being, our processes are different. Everything is unique to our environment, and it always creates the need for, we need custom solutions. We need custom service providers, right? So I then took that approach to say, establishing a software development company would be us approaching clients to say that we are not going to give you anything off the shelf. If we'll required,
customize it more.
If that's what you need, that's what it will be, right? But we want to give you something that's suitable for your processes and what's suitable for your needs.
Okay.
And we quickly found that it was the case. I mean, one of our first big clients, I remember when we approached them, they were spending roughly $1 million to $2 million a month on an enterprise solution where they were barely using it, right? And we built a custom solution just to manage the basic process flow that they needed and cut down the costs by about 90%. So that's, for me, the value that we saw introducing to their clients.
Okay, so now in the early days, you know, where your idea is now validated, you've got traction, your customer base is growing. Were you bootstrapping from your savings, or were you still 9 to 5, you know, doing, you know, one leg in, one leg this side? How were you navigating?
So I think I was very fortunate with my previous employer, where I think 4 months into working with them, I then proposed to the CEO of the company that instead of him employing me, he then employs my company.
Nice.
So my resignation was a proposal.
So that's a nice way to look at it.
We started off with a 1-year contract. That then meant that I don't start at zero, right?
Okay.
So immediately had a client. We had retainer, we had consistent revenue, at least for the first year.
Okay. So your previous employer was your first client?
It was my first client.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So that sort of helped fund the establishment of the company.
Okay,
yeah.
Wonderful. Now, I want to know, because you said something very important, or something, you know, intriguing in the beginning, where you said that you had taken a position as a company not to go for government contracts. Because, you know, a lot of tech companies that are owned by African brothers and sisters are labeled as tenterpreneur because of the over-reliance or reliance on government contract. Why, at that point, were you strategically not approaching government for contracts?
My decision on not working with government, there's quite a lot of reasons behind it. But the initial primary one, and which was what I experienced firsthand from the very first tender that we got, and the main reason is the delays and the processes that exist.
Lack of efficiency.
Yeah, lack of efficiency. I mean, when we got awarded our first one just after the announcement for the hard lockdown in March, and I mean, hearing things and took until August before the project could kick off.
So the project was awarded in March. It only kicked off in August of the same year.
Jeez. And sorry to say this, but stupid reasons, right? I mean, they would say things like, no, the procurement person has been working from home, but the procurement person doesn't have a laptop, the PC is at the office. How are they working from home? So for me, it doesn't make sense how an organization can claim to be functional and be doing such things. If that was to happen in my business, I would shut down immediately, right? So it explains why all the financial issues with any state-owned entity. But that in itself kicked off the project in August, only got paid a couple of months later, and we have to, from our side, fund this project. And that's where I called Q and said, Q, how do I fund this thing? I don't have money, we are broke. And even any other additional existing supports that would exist for funding purchase orders and and financing for COVID during COVID season were just not there, right? Even though government claimed to have all the CEDA supports and all of that, but they were inaccessible.
100%.
Right. So I called him. He said, look, your supplier, I know someone at the supplier. Uh-huh. Let me give them a call. And he vouched for me and they gave me a line of credit there. But still, we delivered overheads. I'm incurring the cost. Uh-huh. We are working on the project. And it still takes months for the invoice to get paid. Even because of that, in the year 2020, December, we had to let go of two guys.
Because of that delay of payment?
Because of that delay of payment. So we retrenched two guys. Fortunately, one of the guys, we recruited him back in March this year. But it's those things. So it became too expensive. Mm-hmm. For me, it looked too expensive before even went in. But and as I saw it, it really was expensive, right? So that's the first point. Mm-hmm. The second point was around the bribery that goes on in this. And for me, I find it quite strange that we've created a norm around it. And we've
standardized.
So it has been standardized as the practice of the thing. So unfortunately, my parents are not veterans, are not affiliated with any political party.
There's
no connection anywhere. So for me, I understood, I knew my lane. Mm-hmm. I knew that firstly, that's not how I want to operate.
100%.
And I wanted to just serve. I wanted to offer a service. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to run my business, right? And the environment is not conducive for that. How the environment is set up, and quite a lot of people kept telling me that you are being naive. You just have to accept that this is how the environment is for business in South Africa. And that contributed to even my decisions around going out of the country. Simply because that's the modus operandi.
And it's such a frustrating when you're in it at that moment. Yeah. It's so frustrating because, you have to retrench people.
Yeah.
You're taking a toll financially at home. Yeah. It's COVID. Yeah. Like there's just a lot going on.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just want to know. So you're saying two issues: efficiency. Payment delays. Mm-hmm. Now, let's just touch on the payment part. Mm-hmm. Because you couldn't get your money up front or in time, let's say that, right? In terms of, luckily for you, you had Clinia, so you could, tap into those connections and networks. But couldn't you raise money during that period with them? So couldn't you go to banks or other sort of credit lenders? What was the experience in terms of fundraising this money to, do this project?
So if you can remember properly, during COVID, lines of credit for business were stopped immediately, 100%. Right, so the banks were not offering credit. Mm-hmm. There were the interest-free loans, the payment, the debt relief scheme for the banks that they were offering, which was in collaboration with government. Mm-hmm. But even that was very limited.
It was very limited.
It wouldn't have been, and I think we only managed to get access to even that credit later on, much later on, about early 2021, which was the following year. Project had already went on, and we had bled, right? So only then things were starting to open up a bit, and things were starting to move. So prior to that, we couldn't access any level of fundraising.
But I just want to know, before the pandemic happened, outside of your first client, which was your boss, how were you able to break into corporate as a client? I think that's really important for a lot of SMEs because, corporate private clients are much more reliable as government. I mean, we've established that. Yeah. How were you able to? I mean, of course, you've got your first leg up by your employer, as you said, but second, third client, just before the pandemic happened, how were you able to break into that?
So we went, or I went aggressive in the sales. I mean, now I'm still terrible at sales, but
now you got a sales department.
So I went aggressive with sales. Mm-hmm. I mean, from even the digital marketing,
100%.
You know, annoying people on mm-hmm. LinkedIn and things like that, and attending tech conferences, exhibitions,
100%,
giving out business cards and cold calling. Mm-hmm. So that's literally how
old
I was doing
way.
It, old school way. Yeah. And look, it was not the success rate of that was not too good, mm-hmm. Simply because of lack of experience and there's no trust or credibility 100%. In the business.
Track record.
Yeah, track record. I mean, we had just the one client, the 100%. One reference. And I remember I even changed my strategy to say, look, maybe let me focus on the small businesses that are trying to get solutions out. Start with those types of mm-hmm. development projects, subsidizing the rates mm-hmm. drastically, just to keep going, right? And we took that approach. It was very difficult because yeah, now you've got about 20 projects, they're mm-hmm. paying you peanuts. You're very busy, mm-hmm. but with nothing to show really for it. Yeah. But we were building that track record, and I think it paid out. Yeah.
And then, you know, I just want you to give me an honest reflection. Yeah. Government versus private. Yeah. Yes, at the time you were not getting a lot, but you were getting the sort of reputation and traction that you needed. What are the benefits of dealing with private vis-a-vis government? And just give me an honest comparison between the two. Yeah.
So I think private, for me, has been based on merit.
Okay.
Right. So it's literally, this is what you're saying you're going to give me. If you deliver it to me, you get paid. And it's much easier to manage relationships there. It's more sustainable for business. I mean, like I said, my very first client was my previous employer. We still do work for them. We still assist them. We still have a relationship there. Some of the very first clients that I've had from our first year in business, we still have business with them, right? So for me, it's more sustainable. It's more, I mean, government, like I said, the processes. They tell you it's a 3-year contract, it's a tender for 3 years. At the end of the 3 years, we need to bid, regardless of your quality of your service and how well you've been good to us. But for me, it's not too sustainable.
Okay.
But on the other hand, which is something that can't be ignored. Government in any country is the biggest procurer,
100%.
Right? So, if you're selling licenses, if you're making money on mm-hmm. Headcount, you would need to go to government,
100%.
Right? I mean, I remember from my T-Systems days, Transnet in itself would have about 70,000 users, mm-hmm. right? If I'm saying I'm taking the same solution, taking it to private sector, I'm probably going to take it to a business down the road, which would have about 500, if it's a medium-sized to large company, 500 to 4,000 users, maybe. So, you know, the rent value of that is incomparable. So government, you're most likely to invoice a bigger check, mm-hmm. But
there's a lot there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, there.
But Tori, so one could also, I can put it to you, and you know, to say that because government is this big entity and you know the checks are big, mm-hmm. You know, I'm just now touching on the fact that if after three years, even though delivery is smooth, you've delivered everything on time, what could say that you know you should tender again for the 3 years because you don't have an sort of an oligarch or monopoly over that specific contract.
Yeah.
So, you know, open up the, you know, the so other companies can also bid with you. What would you say to that?
Look, I think it creates a fair playing field. I think the concept of the tendering process mm-hmm. was to create shared opportunities, right? And I think as a model on its own, or the intention behind it,
it's good.
It's good.
The practicality of it.
Or actually what is being done on the ground is something completely different. And as well, I mean, I think, I mean, we currently, we bid drastically now, right? So, because we don't have connections, so we throw everything.
We have to go through the
I mean, our conversion rate, you're looking at a 1% conversion rate. I remember last year, I think we threw out close to 60 tenders. Mm-hmm. We only got 2, right? So, it's the conversion rate is not so good. This year, it's only when we achieved the 1% conversion rate from so far. But it's not so good. But if you structure it properly, make it part of your process, and then we went back to saying, let's go back to our private sector. Mm-hmm. Let's focus on that. That's what works for us. Mm-hmm. That's what's sustainable for us. And then this comes complementary to the process.
Have you ever been asked to pay a brown envelope?
Multiple times. Huh. And that's why I can confidently say that it has been made a standard. Mm. Because
for my benefit.
Yeah.
How would the conversation go like?
The guys, I think, because it's been practiced for so long. They do it without any impunity. Right.
They just say it like that.
They say it outright. I mean. Chief, this if. And fortunately for us, they approach us after we've been awarded.
Oh, okay, right? Okay, okay.
So I know there's nothing we can do about it. We'll see the hell out of them. So, but they approach it. So you're now in. Mm. If you guys want your invoices paid out faster, if you want things done, if you want projects written off and you paid, and those for me, it explained a lot situations like asbestos where you've got over 200 million paid, nothing to show
for
it. And because for me, it was ridiculous. How are these guys?
How does 200 million just vanish?
How does 400 million get paid so quickly? Yeah. And where for us, it's almost impossible to get a payment 100%. Without showing, getting project. Closeout reports showing evidence of the solution and it working and things like that. But then as you're in it, you start seeing what's happening, mm-hmm. right? You start seeing that this thing, the rot is all the way from the top
to the bottom.
To the bottom. So it's been embedded in the system, and anyone in government who will say that they're dealing with corruption or this bribery thing doesn't exist.
It's too deep.
They're lying.
The cancer's
right?
too
so
deep.
So it's deep, and everyone is aware of it. Uh-huh. Just the same way as we know that, you know, the land grabs in Hillbro and what's happening there. You can look at it and you say this.
It's happening there.
This is what's happening. Police, what are you doing? You're passing the building.
And the person initially passing your judges after.
So we should just accept that we are ignoring them. Right? We should accept that our government is ignoring it. We should accept that our police are ignoring it. Our officials who are sitting up there claiming that they are cleaning up, they are not cleaning up. If that was the case, we would have seen arrests with some of the clear evidence that came out of state capture. So nothing is being done. These things are being overlooked and swept under the rug, and political games are being played. And we just have to accept that because of the government that we have, that's what we will get.
Let me ask you this, and this is the last, not last, but I just will go into another thing. Do you think a change of it, is it a people thing, a process thing, and would technology help in automating that process? I'll tell you why. So in this series of uncomfortable conversations, we're having the CEO of CETA, the new CEO of CETA, Bongani Mabaso. And he talked about using AI in the procurement process of CETA to advocate and vet and all these things. Do you think that would help to deal with that problem?
Look, I mean, I think until we deal with the real issue, because that is us trying to ignore the issue, right? Mm-hmm. We are trying to say, okay, the problem is that this is what people are doing, so let's maybe just avoid the people and not create any consequence management to what's existing. So people, let's have them get away with it and try to find a workaround for it. But even with that, because you're not dealing with the real issue, you will still have situations like where there was an article where, I think it was in Zimbabwe, where an anti-corruption system was built, and they found that bribery was paid to build that system. So when it's almost as if, look, you're creating the problem to fix the problem, and so it's for me, it's not dealing with the real issue. And I think I've been fortunate enough to get exposure to first world countries and countries that are, would say, more developed. And for me, it doesn't make sense. We just need to be pragmatic. We should benchmark against what others are doing. We see other countries, and I mean, you go to the UAE, you get to Dubai, look, everything has consequences. You cross a red robot, when you're leaving the country, you get a fine of about almost 10,000 rands, and you can't leave without paying it, right? So even with the people, a person is driving down the road, he stops on the side of the road to pick up a phone call. And it's not that someone is seeing him, but it has been built, it has been ingrained in them that follow the rules, follow the law, right? So we can't just accept that this is what's happening and just ignore it. We need to address it and we need to deal with it. And trying to find a workaround is not the solution. And for me, we've got a government that is refusing to fix because they are part of the problem.
100%.
And going back to your question around dealing with the people and is it a people problem? It's exactly what it is. And for me, I'm going to outright say it. Someone was saying that we would be nothing without ANC, but we are where we are because of them, right? And they are saying that we don't know what the next party is going to do, the same thing, the next government would do the same thing. But we don't know that. What I do know is that this guy's messed up for 30 years.
100%.
That I know for a fact. There's nothing in the trend of history of the past 30 years that tells me any different. 100%. Right? So all I do know is that we don't know what the next part will do, but these guys, we know what they can do.
And look, the culture of lawlessness, that's what I'm essentially getting from you. It's not, it's scientific. I mean, there's so many reports on reports, Auditor General, state capture, and. So, okay, how do you, what's your hiring process? Yeah. And how do you retain good talent?
Yeah. Okay, so I think from the early days, I started off with what I knew. I mean, like I said, I studied computer science at CTI. And I knew that final year students, we have this software dev competition where we've got a project, right? So you build your own, you build a solution, and then we get graded and there's a scoring. And what I did is I went back to the institution and I said, give me the top five from this year, the past year. I mean, I know I didn't even make it top 30. So I know what it takes to get there. So I was going to. So that's where I was pulling from. And one of our first developer, I think, what came second at CTI in Midrand.
Okay.
So that was him. The our second developer that we recruited was also in that same group, came third. And that the guy who came first, we gave him an offer, and then he got another offer with the company that are sponsoring his bursary.
Competition is tight.
So but that's the process I was following. And then over time, I think 3 to 4 years later, I started working closely with organizations that were funding interns. Mm-hmm. So we would then bring in like funded interns and just upskill them and train them. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of that going on, and a few that were experienced guys that we've dealt with in other projects that mm-hmm. we recruited mm-hmm. and brought on board, yeah.
Okay, and then how do you retain them? What's your incentive to retain?
So for me, it has not been easy to retain, right? Mm-hmm. So, and we started feeling it heavy, I think, last year when, mm-hmm. For example, our very first developer who had been with us for 5 to 6 years, then resigned, got poached by the big guys. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been easy to maintain, because for a small business, it's very hard to create a corporate ladder, 100%. Right? Your growth structure can only go so far. Mm-hmm. So what we then do is we try to introduce development programs mm-hmm. and see if we can find whatever furthering education that they want to further. 100%. And whatever we can do to mm-hmm. support them. And mm-hmm. one of the early things, the things we were doing in our early days mm-hmm. is I was sitting with the guys. Now I don't do that anymore, but I think it would be very tedious for me to do that. But mm-hmm. I used to sit with the guys and I say, what are your personal goals?
Okay.
Because the company was my personal vision, it's my dream.
Gotcha.
And anyone who is employed in the company was helping me achieve my dream.
100%.
Right. So I would say, what are your personal goals? And the very first person that we employed before we brought in developers was a UX UI designer. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that he's into photography and he's into other things that were outside of his work field. Mm-hmm. And we bought the first camera that he was using. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, do you want to do training on mm-hmm. those and those types of things? Mm-hmm. And then he also ventured into his own business, fortunately. But for me, it was, let's look at what your personal goals are okay. and look at your growth plan for that. But it would be very hard now with the SIF team.
I mean, I walked in as we were walking in. It's two floors, first team, you know, second team. And is it still 20 or has it grown? Because it looks like more than 20 people.
Yeah, it's slightly over 20 now.
Slightly over 20 now.
We are now on 22, yeah.
Beautiful. Brother Tori, so I need to understand this, you know, South African labor laws, you know, being an SMME, having more than 20 people, as an employer, mm-hmm. you know, it requires certain things from you. You know, employees have rights, you have responsibilities, and you have rights as well. As an SMME, because, you know, these things of HR, they're easier, or I'd like to believe they're easier when you're a much more bigger company. But being an SMME, you have a 20-person team. Everybody's on the same floor. Everybody knows everybody. How does the South African labor laws, in your experience, do they assist you, or are there sort of barriers in terms of, you know, hiring and firing talent? Because there's a lot of new technology. There's a lot of scaling down or up. How do you navigate that space?
Yeah. So I think. We've never had any issues okay. Internally, purely because we deal with people on a human level, okay. right? So we've never had a situation where we've had to deal with any labor disputes, mm-hmm. And we've never had a situation where we've had to deal with firing in the context of we have to follow procedure mm-hmm. and things like that. But I've always been well aware of the process and what it would require for us to do anything. And that's why we've incorporated a lot of policies around mm-hmm. Disciplinary actions, dealing with some of the issues that we've had with performance and things like that, but dealing with them internally and managing that. But for me, it has not been a problem. What's the problem is not understanding why I have to contribute money to QAEDA every year. Department of Labor. I mean, I thought we are contributing UIF, we are contributing PAYE. Yeah. What's QAEDA for?
Yes.
But,
I mean, let's talk about that. Is it tedious? Before we
brought our HR person, it was tedious because it doesn't make sense. So I managed and it was standardized with whatever mm-hmm. accounting firm we had at the time mm-hmm. was managing our payroll, was mm-hmm. managing our finance and our books, submitting our UIFs and our tax submissions. But then there's this thing, Department of Labor still mm. wants us to declare. Mm. And so that's where even JCRED came about.
Okay.
So it was the inefficiency of the decentralization of information.
It's as if everything can be in the same thing. You do UIF, one thing on one portal.
The strangest thing with us is that for JCRED, our biggest client is government.
100%.
We are taking government information and reselling it back to them. This doesn't make sense.
Mm. Now, I want to get into JCRED because, I mean, you opened it up right now and you know, you won the NetBank Business Ignite Award for that. Mm-hmm. Before we go into JCRED and some of the labor issues that, you know, that inspired that, winning that award, what did it do for you? And how did you benefit? You know, because there's a lot of these competitions that happen Some of them, you know, the return on investment is quite questionable. What did it actually do for you?
Yeah, so with that one specifically, it was firstly cash injection.
Okay.
Yes. So for me, it was more valuable. That was more valuable than any other, I think, competition that you can ever get, because someone was telling. I think it was even Kuniso was telling me that he's went to a podium, going up to a podium to collect an award, broke.
That's what happens on all these competitions because it looks nice from a PR, but you don't get any cash. No, there's nothing to do, clients.
So there was some level of business support that they then offered, mentorship and training, post the award, which for us helped us along the lines of some of the strategy plans that we had.
Okay.
So they helped guide us and sort of model that properly for us. Yeah.
Okay. Now, JCRED as a platform was inspired with the frustrations of, I mean, you articulating UIF and how, you know, that whole process and you know, submitting this, that, and the third. Mm-hmm. Explain this to me.
Yeah.
And I want you to tie it in as you're answering. The labor laws in South Africa, are they against business, for businesses? And as you were building JCRED, which is a data analyzing, data processing tool. We're gonna have the CTO.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend to him in his processing of information, data, submission and all these procurement processes? How would you within the lens of JCRED, how would you advise him advise him?
So for me, what just doesn't make sense is how one government entity doesn't speak to the other,
mm-hmm.
right? One of the biggest use case we've got with our solution is data verification, right? And we've got a recent tender that we got with one of the CETAs, and they wanted to verify the IDs of 25,000 learners,
100%.
Right? And it's a state-owned entity,
that
needs to verify IDs, meaning that they need to verify home affairs 100%. Information. Then they have to go to a private company, which
is facilitate that communication,
to just come and tell you that the ID is valid, right? So for me, it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I'm happy to be getting the business, but it doesn't make sense. And
100%.
And in 20, that's the other thing that's frustrating me with government. 2018, when we're doing an exhibition, we're exhibiting JCRED in Dubai at the tech conference, JITEX, and the Consulate General of South Africa, who's based in Dubai, came with, I think at the time was the Deputy Minister of, I can't remember if it was Transport. Mm-hmm. And they came, they were walking through and they were coming to the South African stands. And I spoke to the Consulate General then about a proposal that we can help with what we've done with JCRED as a structuring, aggregating information. We're currently aggregating information from all government departments, and we said we can do it for government for free. And he then showed me the communications saying, look, he's passed my business card and this.
So he believed in that?
He saw the solution. I demoed it to him that he was amazed by it. And he proposed it to the minister. He sent me the communication saying, look, I'm following up. Nothing materialized from there. And the response was, no, I have to send me the contact details. I have to get in touch with him and I have to. 2019, I'm back in Dubai. Mm-hmm. Same conference a year later. Mm. I bump into him again.
What's going on?
Let's push this thing.
Yeah.
Same thing. Mm. Communicates, nothing materializes. Mm. Following year is COVID. We don't go to that conference. Mm. 2022. Back at the conference last year. Mm-hmm. He's now at the end of his contract. Based there for 5 years. Hmm. He's saying he still hasn't gotten back to you. I'm like, you know, that's not how things work. And he said, you know what? I'm coming back to South Africa. Mm. My contract is ending. Let's deal with it there. He came back this year. We were communicating. Said we would write a proposal. Mentioned that it is explicitly for free. And did the whole proposal, send it through. Nothing materialized. Mm-hmm. And that's my biggest gripe. I mean, with government in South Africa is that practical solutions will not be adopted because of who you are. Mm. No one knows you. So just for that mere fact, it's not on merit. Mm. It's not on anything else other than I do not know you, and who are you with? You know.
So said it to me like you sold it to the Consulate General in Dubai. What is JCRED? What does it do? What problem does it solve?
Yeah. So I think in its simplest form, and I hate defining it in its simplest form because my plans for it are much bigger than that.
And you'll take us to the future.
Yeah, so what JCRED does is it aggregates data from multiple sources. Here in South Africa, we are registered as a credit bureau, so we're aggregating information on credit information. We are pulling information from the traffic department. Mm. We're aggregating information from Home Affairs and CIPC for company information, property deeds office for property information, for different use cases, right? Whether it's vetting, verification of information, but for me, and I was just talking to someone recently where I was saying, as much as it's a KYC platform, you're a customer and you are saying that what you are more looking at is getting to know your citizen, right? So because we use your true form of identification, which is your ID, and trace everything around you from that, from assets, vessels, property, companies, whatever it may be that's attached to you, right? So we have that as a solution, but where we really wanted to take it was with what I've seen going on in the UAE. So in the UAE, everything around you is known, right? Mm-hmm. So they know that Toriso, who has entered the country, I mean, I have a residency ID there, and they know everything about me. Mm-hmm. So from property to everything to even fines and warrants and anything, everything is aggregated, right? So, and we tried rolling out the solution there, seeing how it would work there. And it's almost impossible because government has become so efficient that we have no business there, right? And everything is optimal. I mean, it took me less than 5 days to get a residency ID.
Wow.
In the UAE now. Yeah, in the UAE. And purely because everything is working so seamless. So we then, I figured that South Africa is not the place for us. And we then went beyond our border. We went to Eswatini to pitch the same solution. We pitched to the SPTC, trying to see how we roll out there. We've got some buy-in there, some interest there. We've now rolled out in Nigeria, Ghana. Okay. We just started rolling out in Kenya now. So we're aggregating as much information as possible. We've also got in discussion with their governments there to see how we can help them optimize the data and be a true source of information there. But if the solution is owned by government, it's much that's where we want it. Because what we will do is we will be processing and optimizing their data and aggregating their data from all the departments, and they can then be able to have sort of efficient data processes. You are able to trace a person, which is what we are doing very well in South Africa, the tracing process, and it's the biggest use case that we've got going on.
Okay, beautiful, amazing. Yeah. And going into Kenya, Nigeria, how's been the reception in terms of speaking to government officials? I mean, you've shared a lot in the South African context, but how's you know, other parts of the continent?
Look, I think Africa is Africa. So you get to Nigeria, they say, "My brother, talk to me, talk to me." You get to Ghana, "Brother, talk to me." Get to Kenya, "Brother, you haven't started talking." So
show appreciation. Yeah.
So Africa is Africa, but where we what we do from our side is we our entry point is always what we know best, which is private sector. 100%. So we've entered there starting with private sector, just like what we did with South Africa, where we struggled to get data from government. We used private companies that have access to that data. So we started the same fashion with those African countries. Some of the data partners that we have locally have presence there. So it was easier for us to just soft launch with whatever small data sets that we have. And we are gradually expanding that.
So I understand you're in, just walk me through the countries, Nigeria, Kenya.
So it's Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana. We've got Zimbabwe as well, but sheesh, another trouble environment. They're getting money out there is a problem. And Kenya, and Namibia.
So what's how's been the scaling aspect of it? I mean, you're all in these different jurisdictions. How's the scaling?
So we are operating those contracts from our registered company KTO Global in Dubai.
Okay. So you're operating those different jurisdictions from Dubai.
From Dubai. Yes.
Okay, 100%. And then how does the South Africa is this office in South Africa?
So the South African company is the holding company for
that's the
Dubai company.
Okay. And let's talk about Future Build Ventures.
Yes.
Why did you start the VC firm?
So I think for me it was tied to my experience in raising funds. So when we started the development of JCred in 2017, right? And launched it in 2018. But when we started it, there's a lot of regulations around the data that we've got. So the compliance credit bureau to be accredited took us 4 years to get certified as a credit.
Another tedious process. Yeah, why should it take 4 years?
Government. They would spend a year and tell you that we still haven't touched your application. the process around the requirements for compliance and were very expensive. So immediately, and that's what prompted us to start with the
Visa
exhibitions in Dubai,
yes,
was to mainly pitch and raise funds, right? And South Africa, we had been engaging with a lot of local VCs, and that's where I saw the biggest problem. All the investors in South Africa are very risk averse, as if they are banks, right? Really? So they are looking at sort of established businesses. You look at some of their portfolios are with companies with very good track record, okay, right? And which is far removed from the true concept or definition of what a VC is, right? So VC, looking at the merit of your growth potential, and obviously the quality of product that you have, and what your market looks like. But from what I've seen, it was completely different. All of them had interest, but because it was very early stage for the product, they saw it as very high risk.
Okay.
No one ever said no to us, but no one ever said yes, either. So we've never gotten any funding. And J-Cred did quite well over the years. And what I then started piloting with before I actually entered the VC space is I started exploring acquiring, because we had a lot of companies coming to us looking, having ideas. They want to build a solution, but they don't have the money or enough capital to fund the project. So if we believed in that idea, we would say, look, we would subsidize the cost in exchange for equity. So that was sort of me taking my first step in entering the VC space, whereas we are literally investing sort of time for equity, and we built some of the we got some of the portfolios coming in there. We had about, through that structure, we had about five companies, five products that we invested in. None of them did too well.
Okay. I mean, it's the VC
It's a process, but we've got a lot. We've got quite a few. We've got two out of the five that are very high potential at the moment. They're doing fairly well, but they are still in their early stages. We are seeing how that will go. One is doing quite well with the pipeline that it has. And then we had others that scaled and crashed, right? But that was a learning experience. But 2021, I then got a mentor who has been 20 years in the VC space.
Wow.
Who's
your mentor?
His name is Pindili.
Oh, Pindili, okay,
yes.
Beautiful.
He had been with quite a lot of VCs, okay, and the establishment of quite a lot of VCs, and his background with working with the big VCs that exist today.
Okay.
And he just walked me through the landscape and what it looks like. And he expressed the same sentiments that, yeah, right, the landscape is not the true definition. I mean, you go to your Silicon Valleys in the States, it's a different landscape altogether. Yeah. The risk appetite is very high. You go to the UAE, same thing. People are throwing in money.
Gotcha.
Simply because they understand. And okay, I was looking at, he even shared with me the documentary of the conceptualization of a VC in the States, where it's these old wealthy guys who were just doing money. And one of the guys was saying that, you know, I could have gotten like 20% shares in Apple for about $100,000
back then.
And he's like, look at what it is now. Yeah. And he keeps kicking himself over
that. I want to touch that, because that's a very important, that's a very important aspect. And I want you to be honest, is it because in our context, the people with the money do not look like the early stage businesses on the ground?
In most situations, yes, okay, but I think what's causing the issues that exist is the investors. We've got too many CAs running these VCs, and it's a numbers game for them, okay, right? So it's like I said, risk averse. So they are mitigating a lot of risks, and the VC space is a risk game.
It's a risky game.
Yeah, so they are looking out for their investors, which is all good and well, but still have to have the whole methodology of a VC, which is being missed. So when I entered the space, I mean, when we were trying to raise funding, I remember we were trying to raise something like the first year in 2018 when we launched the product, trying to raise like 1.4
million. 1.4
million.
USD or
rands? Rands.
Okay.
And that was just for compliance. Okay. We needed to get the certifications mm-hmm. out, and it was expensive to get some of the security requirements out and okay. the infrastructure there. So it was a nightmare to raise mm-hmm. that money. And we got business, we continued growing, we then got to a point where we needed to raise further investment. Mm. And we managed to get with Samsung, the EIP equity equivalent program. We managed to raise about 5 million there. And we managed to raise with the Tax Innovation Incubator as well. We managed to raise about 1 million there.
Okay.
And we are still raising for scaling, okay. for especially the other operations.
Okay.
And we got some Dubai investors as okay. well. But all of that showed me what the environment looks like and exposed me to what the need is. I mean, one of the companies that was our neighbors at the very initial incubator were mm-hmm. in Softstart. It's called Dropper, right?
Okay.
And they, same thing, okay. were looking, raising, going to attend the same investment pitches we were doing, and not so much traction. Mm. And only when they got established and were doing quite well, look, they did raise a few rounds, but when they were doing very well, then it started looking appetizing for the big guys. And I know that they got about 60 million or mm-hmm. so dollars last year raise. But it's that, mm. that those high potential opportunities that could have been picked up at a very early stage are being missed out on.
Okay.
So that's what we're trying to fill with that gap.
Mm-hmm.
We are launching our first fund now
okay.
With Future Build Ventures. We've partnered with a company called Season 8 Capital. Yeah. And
it's a South African based?
It's a South African okay. based company. They've also, the founder there, Tabo, is quite experienced in the VC space,
okay.
investment management and fund management space. This is actually his second fund management company.
Okay.
So we've collaborated there to work on the. We've got a fund that we've just legalized now.
Tell us about this new fund that you're currently working on, this project. How much are you looking to raise?
So with this fund, we are looking at raising 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
The fund is going to be having a very simple focus, really,
okay.
Being tech solutions, tech products,
mm-hmm.
all the way from seed funds to pre-Series A
okay.
Type of portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, cutting, because we are looking at also seed funds,
okay.
Cutting as little as a 250,000 check, all the way up to 20 million.
Okay.
This is going to be our very first fund, and I'm actually quite excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we've got a strong team.
So you're looking at from early stage all the way to late stage businesses,
yeah.
startups. And then with your previous fund, how many companies do you have in your portfolio? You mentioned Drop. Right.
No.
So Drop is not.
No, they are a company on their own.
Okay.
So we've had Family Law Database,
okay.
Which officially shut down last year.
Oh, what
that
happened?
Was one of the. So I think the model and that was a very good learning experience
okay.
for me. Some of the opportunities that we took on, and that's why we are now collaborating with business consultants
okay.
who are there to look at feasibility and.
Okay.
making sure that the business is structured right.
Mm-hmm.
The approach and the model with that, and it had huge adoption. So with that one, we're looking at competing with the likes of the big guys, the LexisNexis,
mm-hmm.
In the League of Fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And we launched and had huge adoption with the law firms and launched different iterations of the solution and versions. And one thing that I think we never asked ourselves is why are the big guys charging so high?
Oh, is this not access to law reports?
Yeah.
What was the
solution? It was a digital legal library.
Okay.
So where case summaries and
Juta type of solution.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we did fairly well in market adoption. Subscribers.
Okay.
But I think the cost of managing content and scaling the content was what was killing us.
Okay.
We were even when we looked at the next phase of launching an iterated version, it was just going to be very heavy on capital.
Okay.
So it looked like it was better to close shop.
Yeah.
Than to bleed any further. And so we had that. We've had other investments such as a product called Tri-H Pro, which was mm-hmm. focused on the health sector, specifically emergency services, mm-hmm. medical, responding to hospitals. So we had actually piloted with a hospital in Pretoria, and in their their casualty department, we've set up screens where information is reading into mm-hmm. from the ambulances and paramedics, which was a way of mitigating against the issues of the hospitals not being mm-hmm. prepared for the patients that are coming in and helping with the management of the patients mm-hmm. as they are coming to the hospitals. And a stupid thing like addressing ambulances getting to a hospital and not finding availability there.
Mm.
So that was that. And other portfolios, we had a waste management solution for digital solution that we piloted with in Swaziland as mm-hmm. well. Also tried to pilot with a few estates here in South Africa. The adoption there is not too well, even though the pilots are fairly successful. So we are trying to see how we can better tackle that. We've got another one in the telco space, which is showing the biggest potential, VIVR.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a visual-based telephony system for call centers.
Mm-hmm.
But we, for some reason, have a different use case where for tutoring and teacher tutoring type of model, that's where it's getting the biggest adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's, I think they've just also raised money there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doing fairly well. It's running a few projects that are doing quite well there.
What is future build ventures investment philosophy? And I want you to be very specific and, you know, talking to potential entrepreneurs. Why should entrepreneurs consider your term sheet mm-hmm. over other VCs?
Yeah. So I think the biggest value that I believe that we are introducing is pragmatism, right? In the sense that we've walked that journey.
Mm-hmm.
We understand the process. And my business partner there, a lady named Chichi, who's based in Cape Town, her focus has purely been in, her background worked with Nespers Labs and worked with different ventures around supporting them, around scaling and all of that from a business support perspective.
100%.
And then we've got like Eight Season Capital that is focused on the financials of a business and helping them stabilize that and optimize that. And from our side, coming in from a technical support and technology experience. So we are then there to support the business, unlike what we've seen in most VCs, where it's literally just cutting a check, right? But the post investment support and the growing and partnership. So, 100%. I mean, for me, it's and that's why most of the investments that we do, we say either let's be there with you in a management structure or a board structure so that we can help build this thing with you.
Oh. Thoriso, look, and this is the uncomfortable question. We have a situation in South Africa where Naspers Foundry has essentially closed shop.
Yes.
We have a situation in South Africa where R&B backed, Alpha Code has closed shop. Why are you investing in South Africa? Why can't you just take your money and go to Dubai or go to other markets that are more friendlier, or where you're guaranteed returns for your investors? What is your business confidence in South Africa?
So my business confidence in South Africa, surprisingly, is quite high.
Okay.
I think the one thing that I love about South Africa is the resilience, especially in the entrepreneurship landscape. South Africa is what it is because of private sector. If we were really dependent on our government for the sustainability of this country, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Definitely.
So private sector is keeping this country alive.
Together, yeah.
And you can see that to an extent they are starting to realize that in government, by introducing more partnership with private sector,
100%.
I mean, you see that you can now sort of go and apply for an ID at a Standard Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of taking that level of approach in your operations would 100%. Optimize them greatly. There is no reason why a post service can't be as efficient, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you've got a take a lot type
100%.
Of model. So I don't get why a post office is at the state that it's in, right? I don't understand why Eskom has got the entire market, but it has financial issues.
Yeah.
It has delivery problems.
Yeah.
It has operational problems. Yeah. I was even laughing during COVID when, before the hard lockdown, they said that they are having financial problems, collection problems. They're not raising enough money.
Yeah.
Utilization and all of that, and then COVID happened, and they were even saying that we can't keep up with the capacity and all of that, and then COVID happened, factories were shut down, consumption to the grid was less.
Yeah.
Now they're saying money is a problem now because people are not consuming as much. But what do you want?
What
do you want? Do you want less consumption? Do you want more consumption? For the government is becoming a typical business nightmare.
Okay.
Because a postal service where every South African has to use it for postal services, but they've got the market, but they can't deliver. Right? So it's that's terrible. But if you look at the private sector space, businesses that are surviving today are businesses that are offering value.
100%.
So you look at them, and even in our investment thesis, like, we are looking at high growth potential businesses, not just limited to South Africa. We're actually looking at Africa. But in South Africa, we are saying that your business must be able to scale. So whatever value you think you can offer here, you should be able to offer it everywhere else. Right? So that's the one aspect. But like I said, the environment is not too conducive for business in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I was discussing with someone, and I was saying that, look, if Elon Musk was still in South Africa, it wouldn't be the Elon Musk we know today.
100%.
Right? Simply because it's
the
not conducive.
Doesn't support that vision.
Yeah.
Support,
I mean, one of the biggest VCs in the world, based in the States, is run by a South African as well.
Mm.
He moved to the States at the age of 20 to study that side, but would he have been what he is today
in South Africa
if he was in South Africa? So the environment is not conducive for growth, right? But we do see that there's a potential for people who are bred in South Africa to what they can achieve. So what we need to be able to think of is not limit ourselves to South Africa.
100%.
But South Africa is a place to be, and who wants to go to Dubai? It's hot there. so there's no winter there. I'm going back there next week, and I'm bracing myself. It's going to be bloody hot there. So, but that's my biggest gripe with it. But I understand and I see. Mm. I mean, we are a business ourselves. If if I can't invest in myself, if I don't see myself as an investment opportunity, then I think we are doomed in South Africa.
Yeah. Tori, so you wear both hats, yeah. Two hats, right? You are CEO of KTO, founder of KTO. You're a general partner at Future Build Ventures. How do you juggle between these two positions? Being in business yourself or running a startup yourself and looking to invest in other people's startups. Yeah. What's the benefit? And at the same time, what are the challenges?
Yeah. So the biggest challenge is time, right? We all have the same 24 hours. So, but I think one of my plans at the moment is looking at sort of stabilizing the structures in KTO Digital and ideally the management structure so that it's a well-oiled machine that is sustainable and running by itself so that I can be able to focus on the VC.
Okay. Woo! You've got time 24 hours is it's not a lot of time.
It's not.
No, 24 hours is not a lot of time. Okay. Now, you know, this series called Uncomfortable Conversations, we're gonna be talking to a lot of sort of, you know, business leaders and government leaders, you know, really highlighting the challenges of SMEs and technology, and you know, KTO is a perfect, you know, case study. Your journey and I think your robustness in different, you know, sectors of the economy, be it in fintech, be it in, you know, IT auditing. Now, you know, solving problems, you know, with data aggregation, or is it, with JCred. Borrowing from your experiences and from your journey in running all these things, what problems, if you were to advise whatever, you know, government leader or, you know, CEO of an SCS, a state-owned company, what are the pressing issues that need to be urgently dealt with? If you can identify us those pressing issues and also share some potential solutions.
Yeah. So I think one of the major issues in South Africa is the lack of support around innovation, right? Ooh. So if you look at what's happening, I mean, I see that it's less of that is happening now, but obviously the mindset has still not changed. But you go to any enterprise, you go to even what government advertises as a tender for a solution or for whatever requirements that they have that is a tech solution that they need, they still mention a Microsoft. Mm. They still mention a SAP. Mm. They will still mention a whatever, right? Mm. So. And in my mind, everyone's understanding, when you mention Microsoft, money is going to Microsoft. You are recommending a company, right? Regardless of who's going to be the middleman and the reseller. And
why is it? Is it the confidence in South African tech companies? There's no confidence in the government?
So I remember in our early days, we started off with a CRM solution, right? Okay. An in-house product. And when we kept approaching companies that were using a Salesforce, a Microsoft Dynamics, the common statement that everyone would make is, but you don't have capacity, right? You don't have capacity
to
support.
This is by government.
Government clients, even big private sector clients, you don't have capacity to support us. And my thing is, look at Microsoft. The moment it got adopted by their government.
Got you.
Of course, if he has given me 70,000 licenses, I'm going to have the money to support you.
100%.
I'm going to have the money to build my capacity, 100%. Right? So what is required is your support. Hmm. So you have to be able to say, And maybe the discussion then needs to be preferential appointments or assessments
100%.
Should not be on skin color, but should be on South African, right? Should be on local, right? And that would sort of...
an outcomes-based policy approach to giving out tenders or giving out work to say, not necessarily, and I think that's my problem, right? Yeah. And I'll say this statement. It's very tick box exercise, vis-a-vis outcomes-based.
Yeah.
Who would this contract, by awarding KTO or awarding whatever company, what, the awarding KTO, does it benefit the country the most to give KTO?
Exactly.
How many people or, you know, what outcome, you know, do that, so to say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at massive contracts like the controversial one that was the payment distributor for the
Sasa grants.
The Sasa grants.
Yeah, cash master payments.
Yeah, but they were using NetOne, American company, American solution, billions going there, right? How many payment distribution agents do we have in South Africa? Locally built, fully.
When things go wrong, you know where to find him. He's there. He's mid-range.
Right. We had situations where Oracle had Eskom at ransom for the $7 billion that they were owing, and I'm like, that's money to an American company. Right. And is it that there are no databases? There are no other open source solutions. Nothing that anyone could have given.
What do you suspect? Is it the brown envelope?
So
I mean, look what happened with EOH in the city of Johannesburg, that was...
It's I think at that level it is, right? And they pass it off as justification for many things.
Yes.
No, we needed OEM, we're operating at a high level, and there's benchmarks from other countries and all of that, but you're looking at their solutions, for their local
100%.
Companies, right? So it's that, and I think it's self-interest. But the biggest problem that I've seen with government is our government is that we've got people leading us who don't know what's going on. It's hard for them to go and recommend that we go South African when they don't know what's happening in South Africa, and they don't even have the capacity to understand and comprehend what's going on. So when they are going out to engage. We've had so many situations where we're engaging with these ministers and engaging with them, but you can see that the person just doesn't have the competency to understand and comprehend what you're telling them, right?
Mm.
You're telling them that there are solutions, they are here.
Mm.
Are they willing to listen or can they understand?
Mm-hmm.
That's a different thing altogether. So we have much greater problems than what we know.
And all those problems... You know, let's dramatize this. Let's make it interesting. Those famous late calls that you have with Qiniso.
Yes.
And I'm a pick on CETA.
Yes.
Because, you know, they are they're in charge of technology procurement for government.
Yeah.
So you're on this, you know, we're dramatizing. I'm Qiniso, late night, whatever,
yeah.
I don't know. You've had, you know, whiskey or whatever, yeah. I don't know. Take us through... Take us through your complaints, you know, to the CEO of CETA.
Yeah.
What needs to happen? What are the problems?
Yeah.
And yeah, just take us through that.
Yeah. So it's for me I don't know if it's I'm oversimplifying it, right? I think it's pretty straightforward. And the intention is always then, but it ends up becoming political talk, right? I mean, you look at the likes of CEDA that built this portal for companies that are South African to bring out their solutions, and I don't know what that leads to, but they are saying put your companies there, your products there. Honestly, I didn't bother with that. And even the previous incubator said, no, tourism, put your product there.
Yeah.
Not even one company can come and tell me what that has done for them. And there's R1 million spent on a WordPress site.
Yeah.
But for me, it's quite simple. CETA, are you considering local solutions first? There are solutions that are working. There are solutions that are being utilized. I mean, I met two amazing companies that are doing ERP solutions, mm-hmm. or doing payment solutions. Mm-hmm. I mean, one is even rolled out in the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing solutions that are very, very, very unique. Solving problems that your Microsofts and your SAPs aren't able to solve today. And they are fully locally owned. These guys, they are saying that their business is not here in South Africa.
Mm.
Because in South Africa, if you don't come with an OEM letter that says SAP, they are not going to accept it.
They're not going to accept it.
They're not going to bring an OEM letter that says you're accredited with Microsoft. Mm-hmm. They're not going to accept it. Because they don't know and I'm going to mention this one solution, Echo X, is an amazing ERP solution, workflow management system, automations, amazing, amazing.
Mm.
And these guys and the one company said that they ended up having to go and be headquartered in the States because there they are being accepted on merit.
Accepted on merit.
And when they are showing like for like with a Microsoft there, they are showing that they are coming out as the better solution.
100%.
So here it's not on merit, so these guys need to push more, and it needs to be by regulation. It needs to be on paper, because that's clearly how these guys operate. To change the mentality of the guys internally, because everyone internally just follows a tick box exercise. We've been rejected for our solution because we don't have an OEM letter, but we are saying we are the OEM. You want me to draft a letter to me?
Recommend yourself.
To say I'm accredited for my own product. I'm showing evidence that this is my product built from the ground up. So the guys down there are following tick box exercises. So something needs to change through regulation for 100%. Them to also follow a tick box exercise that 100%. Says you are a South African product.
Mm-hmm.
So you therefore you get preferential assessment, right? So, but it needs to be re-looked at. It needs to be regulated. A lot of basic solutions are not being adopted.
Mm.
I think South Africa, we are in a position where we are a bit further than other African countries, mm-hmm. from my experience, and we've got basic. We are trying to solve big problems. We're still, and this is again the political narrative, we're still mentioning 4R, we're mentioning all these AI things, but can we just get a person going to Home Affairs,
simple thing,
coming out in less than 10 minutes, right?
Because you go there, they say you're offline. Now, offline, yeah,
offline,
half the
it
day.
Takes you, it takes you, you've got my data, you've got everything on me.
Mm.
I still need to wait a month for me to get an ID. I still need to, you get what I mean?
Mm.
You're still going to tell me it needs to be printed centrally somewhere. Mm. I mean, come on.
Mm.
So we are overcomplicating things that's supposed to be simple.
Mm. Okay. Brother Toriso, this conversation has been wonderful, and I wish you nothing but success. I wish you nothing but, you know, it's always beautiful to understand the tech landscape from an SME point of view. And I think what KTO, what Future Build Ventures is doing, it's beautiful. And I wish you nothing but success. Thank you for, you know, coming on to iAfrican Bites. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your experience. And definitely, this is a first of many others. And we wish you nothing but the best. Thank you so much, brother.
Thank you very much.
iAfrican Bites.
Thank you for listening to iAfrican Bites. Please share your feedback with us on our socials. On Twitter @iAfrican. On LinkedIn @iAfrican.com. And check out our other podcasts, The Tefo Mohapi Show, Tech Legal Matters, and The Lead Creator, on all podcast streaming platforms. And also make sure to head over to www.iAfrican.com. That is iAfrican.com/radio. And subscribe for notifications. We'll be right back.